Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
All right. Well, this weekend is anniversary weekend. You probably didn't know that, but 7 years ago this weekend, we had our first public service. We had been just gathering in a home, and 7 years ago, three blocks south of here, we're at 375 now, down at 679 Broadway, we on Broad Street. We gathered for the very first time 7 years ago, and so God has been doing some really exciting things, and I'm grateful for all that He's done. In fact, next week we're going to start a new series. It's a 3-week series called Love God, Love People, Pass It On, based on our purpose, our mission statement. And I'm going to be talking to you about some things that God is going to be doing through us and in us over this next year and ways that you can participate in that. So I'm excited about that. And as well, when we were down there at that place, we started a tradition. You can see back here our cross wall. We had a cross wall back there. And that largest cross is the symbolic of our church family. And then each of the smaller crosses is symbolic of our church families that are part of us. And so each family has chosen a unique cross to fit their needs, to represent their family. And this week, Nancy McArdle, she's been coming to the church for about a year, brought her cross to add to that cross wall. She was in first service, so otherwise I would tell you to make sure and greet her. She has purple hair. That's why she brought us the purple cross. So you can't miss her. And make sure and tell her how glad you are that she's decided to make this her church home. Well, with all that said, let's get into Ruth this morning. We're going to wrap up our series in Ruth, Ruth chapter 4. And as you're turning there, let me share with you a little bit this morning. You know, when I was a kid, when I was growing up, I became very enthralled with the idea of overnight successes, of overnight success stories. And so even as a young person, I began to read biographies of people who were seemingly overnight successes. I remember one of the first ones that made a big impact on me was Lee Iacocca. He had been working for Ford, and he and Chrysler was in the tank, about to just disintegrate, and he took over the helm there and turned everything around with the K car. Now, if you don't remember the K car, you didn't miss anything. But or maybe you owned one and you know you didn't miss anything. Not missing anything. But nonetheless, he turned everything around. And so there was this big story all about him. And they did a biography. And I remember as a kid, I sat and I read that really thick biography cover to cover, all about the things that he had done and how he had gotten there. And it was very exciting to me as well. Later on, I got into music and was managing some bands. And one of my favorite things is whenever a band would come to town, that was like seemingly an overnight success, you know. And so I would, because I was managing bands, one of our bands might be opening up for them or something like that. I would be backstage and I would get a chance to meet some of these superstars who, risen overnight and usually disappeared the same way. And but, you know, one of the things as I was talking to them, I would always ask them about how they became an overnight success. I also remember as a young person when DeLorean motor cars came around, you know, and like seemingly overnight, this motor company, you know, appeared and then almost as quickly disappeared. And there's a lot of, politics around that, too. But nonetheless, maybe your only memory of, you know, a DeLorean is that you saw Back to the Future and you saw that gold-winged car and all. Maybe you owned a DeLorean motor car, but as you know, they disappeared almost as quickly as they came on the scene. But what I learned through all of those conversations and through reading those biographies is that nobody, not one of them, was actually an overnight success, nor were they an overnight failure. That in truth, that the foundation for their success and also for their failures was laid down long before that great rise or that great crash, sometimes both. And what I learned through that was that really it was the sum total of the things that they did day by day, of the person that they were becoming all along, that either, you know, propelled them to great success or brought them great crushing, defeat. And I'm reminded of that, you know, saying that says, Rome was not built in a day. Well, neither is your success or your failure. In fact, it's not the result of a single moment. Instead, the reality is it's built on the long road of obedience in the same direction that brings us to that place of either great success, great failure, or tells us, people around us, who we are. Now, what we've seen over the last few weeks as we've been reading here in the book of Ruth is that legacy is not what we build in an instant of heroism or something that we gain in a moment, but rather it's the outcome of the way that we live our lives. Legacy is the sum of who we are, how we treat persons, and the way that we live our life. A legacy can be good in the case of where we know of great successes. A legacy can also be bad, of where, you know, maybe the history of a family or of your personal history could be tainted by just bad decision after bad decision that leaves us in a bad place. So everyone leaves a legacy, whether that is a great legacy or a bad legacy. Everyone leaves a legacy, and that legacy is the evidence of how we live our lives in the midst of love and loss. With that in mind, we're going to look at Ruth chapter 4 this morning, wrapping up this book, this study. And so if you want to join me there in Ruth chapter 4, I'm going to be reading from the English Standard Version. Please follow along in whatever translation you have, because the one in your lap is my favorite, because that's the one you're reading. Ruth chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, and we read, "Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, 'Turn aside, friends, sit down here.' And he turned aside and sat down, and he took 10 of the elders of the city, and he said, 'Sit down here.' And so they sat down, and when he said to the Redeemer, 'Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, then redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may, for I know there's no one beside you except me to redeem it, and I come after you.' And he said, 'I will redeem it.' Then Boaz said to him, 'The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance.' The Redeemer said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it.' Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and he gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, 'Buy it for yourself,' he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, 'You are my witness this day that I have bought the land from the hand of Naomi and all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon, also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and that from the gate of his native place. You are my witnesses this day.' Then all the people who were at the gate and with the elders said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring of the Lord that will give you this from this young woman.' So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. For he shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him.' Then Naomi, who took the child and laid him on her lap, became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' And they named him Obed, for he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Abinadab. Abinadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse Father David, of course, whom we know to be King David. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. Amen, amen. So last week, in chapter 3, we were learning about Boaz and Ruth and who they were in secret. You know, one of the things is that who a person is in secret is really who a person actually is. And so in this particular case, it was the night after the harvest. And, you know, on the harvest, the practice was that after the harvest was done, after everybody had eaten their fill and drank their fill, because part of that celebration was that they would make from the grains, they would make fermented drink, and everybody would have this great big celebration. And so they had a time of eating and drinking. And then afterwards, everybody would go each to their own home. And they would find their grain pile, kind of like, you know, if you ever watch in a movie and some guy's just, you know, suddenly flush with cash and he throws it all over the bed and then he jumps on the bed and lays in the money as kind of this symbolism of his, you know, his great conquest and of having made that money and he's all proud of himself or something like that. Kind of like that. There was this little bit of an attitude of like, I'm going to lay in my pile of grain and be, you know, rejoice in the fact that I've got this great blessing. The other part of it was is just simply that this was a security measure. You know, you don't just leave your pile of grain anywhere and expect the next morning you come back, it's not going to be gone. And so the part of a security measure was that that night, after they had harvested their grain, then they would each lay on their pile of grain until they were able to put it in proper storehouses or sell it or whatever they were going to do with it in order. Because this was basically like a big pile of cash. I mean, this is their resources for the next year that they are dependent on. And so Boaz is there, and in the middle of the night, Naomi sends Ruth there to find out from him so that she can approach him in secret. Every other time she's approached him, it's always been in a very public setting with workers around and things like that. And he said, look, it's time for you to go to him in the night. And when no one else is around, after he's had his fill, after he's hung out with his buddies and done all his braggadocio and all that kind of good stuff that guys like to do, he said, I want you to go to him in the quiet of the night. And lay down there with him and wait for him. And when he recognizes, when he notices you, I want you to tell him that you want him to be your redeemer. So she does all that. And then she speaks to him in that covenant language that he used in Ruth chapter 2 when he said that his prayer was that God would spread his wing over. In other words, he was using this covenant language to say that I pray that the God of Israel, that though you are a Gentile from Moab, that the God of Israel would enfold you into his people, that he would spread his wings over you like a mother hen covers her chicks and protect you, that he would provide for you, that he would make your way, that he would be your redeemer. And so in that moment, she's saying to him there in chapter 3, look, I agree that God has been good and he's blessed me. And, you know, the truth is that the person who God has used to bless me is you, Boaz. You've been the one. And so what I'd like you to do, would you spread your wing over me and protect me? Would you be my kinsman redeemer is what she's saying. She's not exactly proposing to him. She's just simply saying to him, if you were to propose to me, like, I would like that, you know. And in that moment, he's like, wow, this kindness you've done to me is greater than all the other kind. In other words, what he's saying is that I've seen you work and I've seen who you are, and you're this beautiful young woman. You're a young widow, and you could have anybody you wanted. But you have looked and shown favor toward me, and he's honored by her response to him. He says that this is a great thing. He's highly honored. And so even as he tells her how greatly honored he is that she has chosen him, though he's an old bachelor. He's been at this a while. He's an old bachelor, and what? Why would she take notice of him? She's young, she's beautiful, she's a hard worker. Of course, she's also a Moabite, but that's beside the point. At this point, all he sees is her favor. What the great thing he thinks about her? He's not thinking about how somebody else might not want to marry her because she's a Moabite. He's just noticing her for her beauty and her strength and all of her great qualities, and he says, "Wow. That means a lot to me that you would want me to be your redeemer." So he says, listen, that really, I'm excited about that. But here's the deal. There is someone else that's first in line. And so what we have to do, I've got to give him the shot first. I've got to let it. So if he would redeem you, then blessed be the Lord that we did the right thing. But if not, then I will be the one to redeem you. And then as a show of good faith, because he had confidence that he would get the opportunity, he gives her an offering to take back to her mother-in-law, to Naomi. Now, I've had people like try to, you know, distort what happens here in Ruth, and they're saying, well, you know, he came to her in the middle of the night and he uncovered her feet. That's just a euphemism for that, you know, they had sex and then now he's paying her for the sex or something like that. And nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Instead, what's happened is that in the secret of the night, when nobody else was around, he brings up, he says, yes, I want to be your redeemer. But he points to the law of the Lord. Now, he doesn't say, hey, the law says this and that's what I have to do or something like that. It's just that Boaz is the kind of person who all along, we've seen through all three chapters, that he's continually trying to do what the Lord wants him to do, to walk in accord with the law, to do the right thing. He doesn't have to say, well, you know, I would do that, but I'm a Christian. And, you know, and then the Bible says this, and so, you know, I just can't do that. Exposing the truth of the heart that says, I really would do evil, but I don't want to get in trouble with God. But Boaz isn't like that. See, there's not a dissonance between who Boaz is in the law of the Lord. And so he doesn't have to weakly lean on something because his heart isn't given to wanting to do evil and finding excuses for why he can't. No, he just simply says, look, this is what we need to do because it's the right thing to do. It tells you a whole lot about the character, the person of who Boaz is. See, there's nothing weaker than when a Christian says something like, well, I can't do that because I'm a Christian. Can I just tell you that you may have stood the test in the moment, but the truth is you revealed your heart when you said that the only reason you're not doing it is because you're afraid of the law of God. You're afraid that you will be found out. You see, what he was doing is he was speaking out of the character of who he was, so he didn't have to have an excuse. He didn't have to say, boy, I would do this wrong thing. I would do this illegal thing. I would have sex with you if I wasn't a Christian. I would steal your money if I wasn't a Christian. I would take this shifty deal. I would do this underhanded thing if I wasn't a Christian. No, he just simply says, the right thing to do is this. And if he would redeem you, then bless him and bless you. But he wants to redeem her. He wants to redeem her, and he wants this to happen. And so he says, in good faith, to show you that I'm really being earnest, here is a down payment. Here's the deposit for the land. You take this back to Naomi so that she will know that I am acting in good faith. I'm giving her a deposit saying that it is my intention to redeem the land, to redeem her, and ultimately to take you as my bride. It's a powerful statement in that. And so we find out who they are in that secret moment when there was opportunities. She could have done certain things. He could have done certain things. And yet when no one was around, their integrity was still in place. And they honored God and they followed the law even when it was against their own desires. But never having to say, well, I would do this thing if God didn't say. No, he said, we must do the right thing. And he followed the protocol of the law and did what was right by the Redeemer. Now today, we're taking a look here at these events. And we consider that Boaz, here in this last chapter, is again doing the right thing by going to the first Redeemer. So he goes out into the land. And I want you to remember to yourself that Bethlehem, you know, sometimes when we think about Bethlehem, because we've heard the stories of that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, that King David was born in Bethlehem, sometimes in our mind, we have this grandiose idea about Bethlehem. But as I've mentioned all through this series, the thing is that Bethlehem is literally just hundreds of people, not even thousands. In fact, the Bethlehem of Boaz's day and of the day of King David later on was lost to us in antiquity, that the Bethlehem of the first century is actually a few miles away from where the original Bethlehem was. And even the Bethlehem of the time of Jesus was a little tiny hamlet, very small town, about 13 miles from Jerusalem. Today, it's basically a suburb of Jerusalem because Jerusalem has grown so and overtaken it. But we know from antiquity, from church history, that there was even a period of time when they didn't know whether or not Bethlehem had actually existed in the time of David and things like that. Because it was such a small town, it just disappeared. So I want you to think for just a moment. Here's little Bethlehem, and he gathers together all of these people. He's gathering together 10 of the elders of the people. So you've got to think to yourself a couple of things. Why the 10 elders? Well, first of all, 10 in the Bible is a very significant number. If you think about it this way, that in when Abraham made that first offering to Melchizedek, long before the law of God was in existence, and so he made that first offer to Melchizedek, and he gave him 10% of all that he had as an honor, as a blessing to the priest and king named Melchizedek. It's also 10% is part of, according to the law, is what was given by the people of God to sustain the priesthood. So they would give a tithe to the priesthood to sustain the Levites. They also gave a second tithe to the tabernacle and later on the temple for the same purpose, to sustain it. And then there was their other offerings that they did in the course of worship that was another tithe. Actually, it was closer to 13% when you talk about all the offerings and sacrifices and things that they would do, for a total of about 33% of their income overall. But this understanding from before the law was written and from very early on was that this number of 10 being a foundational number. In fact, later on in the exile to Babylon, it would take 10 families in order to have a synagogue. So 10 families would gather together. That would allow them to pay a rabbi to come and to teach and to help them and so forth. And so there were this idea of 10 was a significant number. Now, when you're talking about this town of Bethlehem and you're thinking about just a few hundred people, consider also that these were large families for the purpose of farming, a very agricultural climate and everything. So when you say 10 of the leading families, 10 elders, you're talking about basically almost every man in town. So he's basically calling the whole town to come together as witness of what he's doing there that day to make sure that he's wholly accountable before everyone before him. But then he also brings aside his relative there that he's related to through Elimelech, and he sits him down and he explains to him, and he says, hey, our relative Naomi, our relative because of Elimelech, she is in need of redemption. You know what's happened, you know what she's been through, and here it is, it's right after the harvest, so everybody is flush with cash, if you will. You know, there's times in life when you want to do something, but you may not have the resources. But everybody at this moment, this is the wealthiest they have all been in 7 years. Remember, there had been a famine in the land of Israel. This was in the time of Judges. At the end of Judges, it says, and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And so the hand of God's judgment has been against the people of Israel for 7 years and a great famine. That's why Elimelech and Naomi and all their family originally went to Moab. They then were struck with a time of famine, and God uses that to bring Naomi back home to her kinsmen to seek relief, to find hope, and she brings with her her daughter-in-law, Ruth. But at this moment, this is the best off they have been in 7 years. At any point in time. And so he says to his cousin, hey, you know, cuz, look, everything is good. We've just had this wonderful harvest. And so Naomi is here. She's come back. And she needs us to step up to the plate. Now, what you don't know is that in the Old Testament law, there are very clear guidelines on how you're supposed to take care of your family and the expectations. Part of it was that when God gave the land of Israel to Israel, that in that land parcel was given to you and you couldn't, it was yours forever. It belonged to your family forever. So it could only actually be sold or redeemed by a family member. If you sold it to somebody who was not a part of that family, if you sold it to somebody even who was another Israelite, you waited for the Jubilee. Every 50 years, that land would return back to the original family that owned it. So whenever you would sell the land to someone who wasn't part of your family, then what would happen is that you would basically lease it for 50 years or 49 years or 48 years or 1 year, depending on how long until the next Jubilee. In fact, one of the things that often caused problems between Gentiles who moved into Israel and the Israelites was that sometimes they would sell the land for what it was worth and go, oh, surprise, it's Jubilee next year. Not very ethical. So this practice of Jubilee would be a time of it restoring to the life. So everyone there would know that it was very important that it had to follow into the family line, belong to one of the kinsmen redeemer. And so he's making sure that everybody knows what's happening, that they're seeing whenever he draws off the sandal, that they're knowing the extent of the bargain. See, here's the thing. Have you ever been tempted to take a shortcut or to do something in a maybe less than ethical way? You know, I can think of times like maybe when in the process of buying a house or something else like that, or making an agreement, and someone would say, well, you know, if we do this and nobody catches it, nobody will know a thing. And I can remember thinking to myself from very early on that that was a really bad idea, because I didn't want to constantly be looking over my shoulder wondering if I might get caught later on. See, just because you didn't get caught in the moment doesn't mean it can't catch up with you later anyhow. One of the things whenever I was working on my doctorate degree they told us, you know, it's really important that you keep track of all of your research so that you can prove that you've done this work yourself with all integrity. See, while I was in the program, there was a man who had written his dissertation 10 years earlier. And someone was doing some other research, getting their doctorate degree, and discovered that his dissertation was almost word for word lifted from someone else's dissertation. They called him in, and they called an accreditation committee from the Southern Association of Schools and Colleges, North Central Association of Schools and Colleges, and they set a review board, and they started going over everything. And he kept saying, no, 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 I really did this research. And they said, prove it. Prove it. But he had no proof. And when the day was done, they not only stripped him of his doctoral degree, but of his job as a professor, and it began to affect the accreditation of the other schools that had hired him. It had a huge impact on a lot of people's lives, because most likely he took a shortcut that he thought nobody would catch him when he walked across the stage with that degree. Here, Boaz is being a man of great accountability. So he says, not only to the person that he's making the agreement with, but he calls the 10 elders. He's basically calling the whole city there to be witness of what he's doing that day, so that there's nothing that could be seen as being underhanded. Furthermore, he says something that's really intriguing. In that process, as he's explaining all this, he calls it out and says, and remember also Ruth the Moabite. See, it's really important. See, at this moment, it would have been really easy in this point in time for someone to have said, but she's a Moabite. She's a Gentile. We owe her nothing. She's not family. It's not our fault that he ran off to another land, that they brought back this bride from another country. They could have easily said, she is not a covenant member. She is not a Jew. She is not under the protection of the covenant. They could have easily said all of that. But here's what's happened, is in the process of her coming back, of her walking with the Lord, of having stood by her mother-in-law, of having called upon the name of Yahweh, of having sought the protection of Yahweh God, and to be under his wing, under his protection, as she's been doing this whole thing, everybody in the community knows who this woman is. Remember, it's just hundreds of people. But to make sure that everybody knows who she is, and to make sure that he's clear about all of this, he's asking for her, this Moabite woman, to be brought under the protection of the covenant of Israel. He's being clear on every regard of this. There's no underhandedness, there's no sneakiness, there's no secret deals. He's making sure that everyone is clear. There's at least two reasons for that. One, Boaz is a man who's after God's own heart, who's pursuing the Lord God, and doesn't have to say things like, well, you know, the law says this, or make some excuse for why he does the right thing. Remember when Ruth came to the field for the first time and was gathering gleanings, that this was their first good harvest in 7 years. Can you imagine? I mean, wouldn't it have been easy to have said, well, you know, I know I'm supposed to tithe, but, you know, we've had 7 hard years, and I know I'm supposed to do these right things that are right by the poor, but, you know, we need to take care of ourselves first, and then we'll get around to doing what's right by the Lord, or something like that. I mean, there's all kinds of justification, but instead, what they knew about Boaz is that he was the kind of man who did what was right when it was convenient and when it wasn't convenient, so much so that even his hired hands in the field knew before he ever got there that they would want to make room for her to glean in the field. So in the midst of maybe a time where a lot of people would have said, well, you know what, I've got to make up for lost time here. I mean, you know, I haven't had a good, it hasn't been a time of great blessing or whatever. And instead, Boaz does what's right before everyone. And now in this moment, where his heart is surely attached to Ruth, I can't believe that a beautiful young thing like you would want an old man like me. You've done me a great honor. First, we must find out if the other redeemer would redeem you, because he's first in line. And here's the thing. He just wanted to do what was right before the Lord. Second, he wanted witnesses to be there present so that what was established would be established before the whole community. And then third, in that moment, whenever he took the chance to ask, you know, this guy to redeem it. And he says, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm flush with cash. Things are looking good. I'm going to do that. He says, okay, but remember, I'm not only asking you to take care of Naomi, but I'm also asking you to take care of Ruth, the Moabite. And in that moment, he says, well, you know, I can't. I can't do that. It would affect my own inheritance if I do that. So in that moment, he passes the opportunity to Boaz to redeem her. And Boaz, flush with the cash of all of this, great, having the opportunity, he seizes it instantly. And not only does he make a declaration before the whole of the city of his intent, not only does he do this all above board so that no one can say later on, hey, that was a sneaky deal, the way you didn't mention that Ruth was, you know, a Moabite, or boy, you didn't say that you know, that there was this other, you know, advantage to it, or you didn't say that you wanted to marry her, or, you know, all the other things that people could have slipped in later on and called into question. No, he's got all the witnesses of the city that there could be. So that what is said and done is being said and done in front of everyone. There is no question about his ethics. Secondly, he's making it very clear she's a Moabite, and there's every reason for them to not want to do this for her. And what he's clearly asking for of the people of Israel is, will you, along with me, bring her under the protection, the covenant protection of Israel? You know, one of the films that I enjoy quite a bit at Christmas time is, have you ever watched The Nativity? Anybody ever watched the film The Nativity? One of my favorite scenes there is that after Joseph has agreed to keep Mary, after he's heard from the angel and he knows that what's conceived in her is the Holy Spirit, they're called to do the census and to go back to Bethlehem, you know. And so they're getting ready. They're walking out of town. She's riding on the donkey, and everyone is giving them the stink eye because they think they've been fooling around before they were formally married, right? And so everybody's looking at him, giving them dirty looks, and he goes, they're going to miss us. And you know he's saying it tongue-in-cheek. He's like being funny because everybody has got nothing but contempt for them. Can I just tell you that in a little town of hundreds of people, everybody knows who Ruth is. Everybody knows she's a Moabite. Everybody knows that she's outside of the covenant relationship. And if he had just simply married her, she would always be that Gentile woman. What he does in bringing her before those 10 elders is not only is he saying, look, I am willing to redeem Naomi, and I'm going to take care of her and all that she needs, but also I'm asking you to recognize Ruth is a covenant member of this community. I am willing to spread my wing over her. I'm asking for you to recognize her as a follower of Yahweh God. I'm asking you to not talk behind her back and say things in a town of a few hundred people. I'm asking, do you recognize that in my redeeming this land and redeeming Naomi, that I am also redeeming Ruth? And in that moment, with everything clear before everybody, when everybody knows what is exactly what's going on, they speak this word of blessing over them. May she be to you like Leah and Rachel. Leah and Rachel were the wives of Jacob. The 12 tribes of Israel descended from those two women. In other words, what they're saying is, just like she was the bearer of a covenant family, so too they are receiving her into their community. They're saying, Ruth is a part of this community. She's under the covenant blessing. We recognize her. We believe that God can use this Gentile woman in your life. And we're praying God's blessing that as you have redeemed her, as you've done what's right before the law, so then may God also do what's right before you and bless her so that she has all of these children and that you will be just like Israel, that the land would be blessed just like it was by Israel because of you doing the right thing here. And so he's made it clear that he's done nothing underhanded. And he's made sure that she's welcomed into the community of believers, that she's taken care of. You know, in the midst of all of this, one of the things that I think is interesting in this whole thing is that I've had people over, you know, the time of going through this have asked the question, well, you know, he did that whole thing where he offered to let the first redeemer have her. Do you think that maybe he really wasn't that into her? Or maybe, you know, I mean, like, was he trying to get rid of her, you know? Do you think that maybe he just wanted the land and not her? Or he was just trying to be a stand-up guy and he didn't mean it or whatever else? And here's the thing I know, is that in the midst of this, that one, he did it in a very public way to make sure that everything was above board. Two, that he made sure that she was in that covenant community. But second, you know, the third thing is that he was very clear to her on that night. You've done me a great honor. You've done me a great service. You've spoken blessing over my life by welcoming me in, by telling me that you want me to be the one that would redeem you. And he showed his intentions by the gift that he gave Naomi that night to bless her. Do you realize that if the first kinsman redeemer had said, yes, I want the land, I will take care of Naomi, and I will marry Ruth the Moabite, that he wouldn't have gotten his deposit back? You see, he showed with his full heart who he was, why he was doing it, and that he was upholding the law, because even though his heart wanted certain things, he was determined to do what was right by God, because the greatest thing in his heart was not the passion of the moment, but in living in accord with the law of God, in doing what was right. That no one is exempt from being, you know, used by God or doing the right thing simply because I've got other plans or there's things I want. And here's the thing. When you look at these great plans that God had in mind, remember Naomi, just a housewife, right? And yet, because of the impact of her life, she lays a foundation in her home, so much so that Ruth, a Moabite, begins to love and to honor and to worship the one true God, to worship Yahweh. They had plenty of gods in Moab. They had plenty of other ways that she could have worshipped. There were plenty of opportunities for her to go back. And even in this most difficult of moments, when she would have been justified to go back, here's the thing, she followed her mother-in-law. She followed her mother-in-law not just to any place, but to a land that was hostile to her, and to a land whose identity was wrapped up in the relationship with Yahweh God. She's going back to a land that had been in a time of famine, not a lot, a time of great feasting. It just so happened that there would have been great blessing where God had prepared the way, making it good for Naomi to go back and to be taken care of by her family. God was making provision in a way that they had no anticipation or understanding, just being in the land to the south. Naomi was just a housewife. And in the midst of that, she sets things in motion by her following after God and by loving God, so that even though in that first chapter we read that she said, "Call me Mara because I'm bitter, because I've had this terrible time and God's hand seems to be against me." Have you ever noticed that in the rest of the chapters, she's never called Mara? Even though she tells them, "Call me Mara," because she speaks out of a sense of a broken heart and pain that she's going through, that the rest of the time that everybody calls her Naomi, that everybody recognizes her for who she is. And as we close out the book of Ruth, we see that she's still known as this woman Naomi, not as Mara, because the reality is that her life is not defined by one single moment of grief or by a bitter word spoken or by her hurt or her pain in an instant, but by the character of her life, the kind of life that brought her daughter-in-law to leave her own land and to follow her mother-in-law, to take the name of Yahweh God as her God and to walk with them the rest of the days of her life. But Naomi's just a housewife, right? She's a housewife who could have excused herself in the loss of her kin. She's a housewife who could have rejected her daughter-in-law because she'd seen her as a burden. But she loved Ruth and in the midst of her loss, treated her rightly and with dignity without making excuses out of her pain. And then there's Ruth. Just a widow, right? Just a widow from a foreign land. Just a widow who's lost everything in her youth. It would have been really easy, and no one would have blamed her if she had stayed in the land of Moab. It would have been really easy, and no one would have blamed her if she'd gone back to the gods that she grew up with. And yet, as she's following after God, and she finds out who this God Yahweh is, and she learns about this God from her mother-in-law and sees the consistency of her mother-in-law's life and the way she walks, even in the midst of her pain, even when she had a legitimate excuse to turn her back on her, she doesn't. And so she refuses to turn her back on her, to abandon her mother-in-law. And she not only goes with her mother-in-law and honors her mother-in-law and goes to a foreign land and honors the name of Yahweh God, but then she does such an excellent job of taking care of her mother-in-law and following the law of God that the whole community begins to recognize her as someone who's significant, who stands out. That even before Boaz knew who she was, even before Boaz knew that he had any responsibility to her, that she stood out as someone who was working hard in the field, bringing honor to herself. But she's just a gleaner, just a beggar, just a Gentile, just a woman from a foreign land. And then there's Boaz. Remember, he's just a farmer. A farmer who keeps his commitment to trust God and to keep God's law. And so that even after times of great famine, he's still allowing the gleaners to be in his field. Even when times have been hard on him, he's looking to honor the Lord. So much so that when the blessing does come, his hired men never think that it's okay to push off the gleaner or to get rid of them. No, because they learned in those 7 years of famine that Boaz was the kind of man who lets the gleaners glean even when it's hard. So that whenever it was a time of abundance, they never even had to ask the question, "Would you want us to do right by the gleaners and according to the law of our God?" No, they knew that was the kind of man that he was. He was just a farmer who trusted God and kept his law without ever having to say, "Well, you know, I would do this, but the law says." And eventually, Boaz, who was just a farmer, Ruth, who was just a widow, Naomi, just a mother-in-law, just a housewife. That God uses them in the midst of their very ordinary, simple circumstances to build a dynasty that will eventually bless the whole world through the King Messiah, Jesus Christ. Their grandson, their great-grandson, is going to be the King of Israel. But they didn't know that. The books had not been written. See, there's no point in which their intrinsic motivation was, you know, if we will be really good farmers today, if we will be good gleaners and we will just do what's right by God, you know, someday, our children are going to be kings. See, that was never the motivation. The motivation that led Boaz to do the right thing, why he never had to cite what the law said, but simply spoke it as to be the right thing to do, was that deep from within, his character, his nature was being shaped by who God is. And so, as just a farmer, he did what was just. As just a young widow, she did what was just and right. You see, right there in the midst of their very ordinary circumstances, God used them. In the midst of their little town in the middle of nowhere, God used them to build a dynasty, to impact the whole world. You see, the point is that ordinary lives lived in a way that glorifies God have huge implications for the kingdom of God. We can't begin to underestimate and think to ourselves, well, I just live in Brooksville. I'm just a rancher. I'm just a teacher. I'm just a postman. I'm just a chiropractor. I'm just a lawyer. I'm just. You see, we don't become great successes. We don't see great things happen in someone's life and overnight. It is a fool's errand to believe in the overnight success. The reality is that what looks like the overnight success is born in those minute details, in the mundane, in the everyday of what we do day by day, day by day, becoming who we are, building a legacy. For better or for worse, you and I are building a legacy. You see, the things that you and I do in those everyday events, the way that we make our family feel, the way we make our coworkers feel, the people who report to us, the checker at the cash and carry, when you're ringing someone up at the 7-Eleven, you are building a legacy. It doesn't happen in the crash-bang moments. It doesn't happen in the great opportunities. It's not in the bigger, better deal. There's no BBD that changes your life, that transforms you, that suddenly makes you a hero. No, a great legacy is born in those individual moments. And the sum total of those moments is your legacy. Likewise, can I just tell you that in moments like that of Naomi, where she cried out in her hurt and her pain and in her bitterness and said, the Lord has come, put his hand against me, call me Mara. Can I tell you that that one moment didn't define her life either? You see, it's the sum total of those things. And so you may find yourself in a place where you've made decisions or done things and you look at the pain of those things and the things that you've done wrong and you think, how will I ever recover from that? Can I just tell you that that's why Naomi is there? Naomi is there to remind us that that is not the sum total of who you are and the total of your experiences. And that yes, by the power of God and by the power of His Holy Spirit, you can recover. Your life can be restored. Likewise, Ruth doesn't become the grandmother of kings. Boaz doesn't become the grandfather of kings in a single heroic moment and the right and doing the right thing at one time. But it's that series of events of him making choices again and again and again, so that the mundane, ordinary events of our life serve to advance the extraordinary purposes of the kingdom of God. When we think that God cannot use us, when you think that I'm just from Brooksville, I'm just from Spring Hill, I'm just from Inverness, you've said more about your view of God than you've ever said about the humility of your circumstances. In the midst of your everyday events, who you are, how you make people feel, in the midst of love and loss, you are building your legacy. Let's stand together. I said it before, and I say it again, not in a harsh way, but in a reality check. That only a fool believes in an overnight success. Can I tell you that one of the things that they've discovered in following musicians at the Juilliard School of Music is that it didn't matter how much talent somebody came into that school with, that it didn't matter who their parents were or whatever they had when they launched out, when they started into the school. But instead, as they followed those who graduated from the school, what they found is the single greatest thing that determined success was whether or not they put a minimum of 10 hours a week in practice of their instrument. They said that as they looked at the success of those graduates, that everybody, without exception, who put less than 10 hours a week into their craft never made it out of the starting gate, never became a success. But those who always put in that 10 hours a week or more of practice, regardless of their skill level going in, regardless of their natural talent level, that every one of them, without exception, became a great success in the eyes of Juilliard School of Music. Can I just tell you that what you do day by day is the thing that matters most? Who you are when no one is looking, when you're on your pile of grain and you're celebrating the goodness of God, when you're laying on a very small pile of grain and you're wondering what God is doing in the midst of this, when you're in your times of you're in a foreign land or in a hard place and you're calling out to the Lord and wondering where He is, that all of these things, these are the things that are determining our legacy. Everyone is actually the painstaking results of what they do over time. Whether we're doing the right things over time, and there's a great breakthrough that everybody takes notice, or whether we are constantly doing things that undermine us, and even those things eventually undermine our great success in a terrible way. So let me ask you, in the midst of love and loss, in the course of the ordinary, everyday life, who are you becoming? What legacy are you laying behind? What foundation are you laying for a legacy? What will be said about you when all is said and done? What steps are you taking to get there right now? For some of you, you know, just staying on track, one of the most important things you could do is just maybe get into a life group or something like that. And I just tell you that one of the great things about a life group is you begin to do life together and connected to other people, and you hold each other accountable, and you pray with one another over the ordinary events of life and do life together. For you, maybe the road to success is in those simple everyday things, and joining a life group might be a great way to get you started. for others of you, you're here today and you found yourself in those in a Mara kind of moment where you've cried out against the Lord and you've been angry at him. And even now you're thinking that all is lost. Maybe it's something just as simple as that New Year's resolution that you've already given up on. You've seen your failures and you just want to beat yourself up over those things. And can I just tell you that the first day of your resolution is today. It will be tomorrow as well. And the day after that and the day after that. Can I just tell you that everything that I've been successful at in my life, everything that I've been able to attain has not been in that I did it all perfectly. It meant that on the day whenever I failed, whenever I messed up, that I got back up and I started on day one again. And I just kept walking day one every day until I found myself in the place I want to be. That's how you build a legacy. And so maybe you're here this morning and you've had your Mara moment, or maybe even a succession of Mara moments, and you're thinking to yourself that maybe it's too late for me. Can I just tell you, it is never too late for you. And so I want to invite you. There's prayer team members up here that you can pray with. You can pray with them about your Mara moment. Maybe there hasn't been the Mara moment, but you've just thought to yourself, you know, there's no way that God could use me. I'm just this, or I'm just that. I'm just here. And so maybe this morning the need is for you to let go of all the justification for why you can't do what God has called you to do. Maybe it's time to let go of all the excuses that get in the way of your legacy and to simply say, God, here I am. I need your strength. I need your power to walk me through in this moment. And maybe, just maybe, you've been trying to walk faithfully along with God all along. You've seen his fruit in your life and you've seen good things, but you're always wondering when the big event's going to happen, when something more significant will take place. And can I just invite you, will you come and get some prayer and hear from the Lord God Almighty? Hear from your Father who loves you. The well done, good and faithful servant. Would you hear from the Father that he is able to do with you in your just circumstances what you never thought he could do? Will you trust him? Would you lean on him? Let's worship the Lord together this morning, shall we?
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.